Time is of the essence when identifying and resolving issues in your software, and our friends at Raygun are here to help. Their brand new alerting feature is now available for crash reporting and real user monitoring, and they'll make sure you're quickly notified of the errors, crashes, and front-end performance issues that matter most to you and your business. You can set thresholds for your alert based on an increase in error count, a spike in load time, or new issues introduced in the latest deployment, along with custom filters that give you even greater control. You can assign multiple users to ensure the right team members are notified with alerts linked directly to the issue in Raygun that'll take you to the root cause faster. Never miss another mission-critical issue in your software again. Try Raygun Alerting today and create a world-class issue resolution workflow that gives you and your customers peace of mind. Visit Raygun.com to learn more. Their simple usage-based plans start from as little as $4 a month with unlimited apps and users. That's Raygun.com, R-A-Y-G-U-N.com, to start your free 14-day trial. Hey friends, sometimes at a big tech company, a famous person who's written a book or is promoting a charity will come around and give a presentation. They'll speak to the big tech company because they can get hundreds of thousands of people to hear their message. Recently, as part of Microsoft's Outside In internal lecture series, I got to talk to David Copperfield, the magician, about his new book, David Copperfield's History of Magic. I also got to visit him in Las Vegas at his private magic museum. It's absolutely amazing. I would encourage you, if you can, to check out my YouTube channel because we have a video version of this same interview there as well. This is going to be the podcast version of the same interview. And this is in partnership with our friends at Outside In and David Copperfield. I want to thank him for allowing us to publish this in two places. And do check out his great new book, David Copperfield, History of Magic. Fantastic book for the kids, coffee table book, or possibly for the holiday season. Here we go. Hey friends, during my day job at Microsoft, one of the things that I've gotten a chance to do once or twice is talk to a famous person about their book. Sounds weird, but actually big companies like Microsoft, Google, and Amazon have these tours where a famous person who's maybe selling a book or talking about a movie or something will come through and they'll do a lecture series. And an opportunity came up for us to talk to David Copperfield, the magician. And he has got an amazing book. This is not an advertisement. And David Copperfield's History of Magic, and he was going to come and do this lecture. But instead of coming to Microsoft, he said we should come to him. So we took a day trip to Vegas, and we got to go to his secret magic museum. And we presented this talk internally. It was an interview with David Copperfield internally at Microsoft. We've talked to David and our friends at Microsoft, and they've said that I can put it up on YouTube for you to see. David Copperfield's History of Magic is a great book. Again, this is not a sponsored thing at all. It's just a really cool opportunity to talk to a really cool person about really cool stuff and the parallels between magic and technology. So thank you to both Microsoft and to my new friend, David Copperfield, for this interview. And here it is. Hey, friends. Behind me is Houdini's entire life. That's just one of the rooms in the giant International Museum and Library of the Conjuring Arts. This is David Copperfield's private secret museum. This is just one of the rooms in this multi-floor masterpiece. We're going to get to chat with him today on Outside In. Hey friends, I'm Scott Hanselman, and it's Outside In. We are fortunate enough right now to be inside the secret museum of David Copperfield. Certainly you know that name because the name Copperfield is synonymous with magic and has been for well over 40 years, 50 years if you count his time as Divino, the boy magician. I want to thank you for hanging out with me today, sir.
I'm going to have fun.
It's going to be great. And I very much enjoyed reading your book right now, David Copperfield's History of Magic. I've taken the opportunity to dog ear it and highlight it. So I've got a lot of questions. It is really a lovely encyclopedia.
You got a softback galley version.
Yeah, this is a pre-printed version, but you can get a hardback version for your coffee
table. Which we'll get in a minute.
Really? Yes. Oh, lovely. Well, that's even better. Thank you for that gift. So in looking at this, myself being a technologist of over 30 years, I started thinking about that relationship between inventors and magicians. And I'm starting to think that the line's quite blurry. Are they the same thing?
Well, the people that move the art forward certainly are. You know, people that invent new technology, invent new magic. We have a very great parallel path between people who are inventing new things that make people dream. And we're going to talk about this. You know, Da Vinci, for example. I use this as an example. Da Vinci worked with a gentleman that wrote one of the first books in magic, mostly mathematical things. And so the fact that Da Vinci loved the art that I love means a lot to me. I take a lot of strength from that. But we're always trying to invent new things, reinvent new, using technology that exists, but also inventing new technology to make miracles happen that hopefully will inspire people.
Yeah. Arthur C. Clarke, famous science fiction writer, has a wonderful quote that I think everyone knows, which is, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And, you know, like, for example, I took some notes on an e-ink display, and that's magical, and I've been doing this long enough that I should know how this works, but it feels like magic. Are there technologies that you're still, like, enthralled with?
Well, I mean, we take so much for granted. I mean, just a phone, our iPhones now, the fact that we can, you know, talk to each other and FaceTime with each other and Zoom with each other, it's an amazing thing. And, you know, I love when people complain about it. My phone has latency and it is, you're talking to your friend around the world in seconds, you know. We kind of take things for granted, I think. And it's amazing that, you know, right behind me is a prop of Alexander the Man Who Knows. The way he knew was with technology, using things that didn't really exist. People didn't know about them back then. A speaker was magic. You know, the fact that a speaker could speak, a card would be selected and you'd go up to his little Buddha and the Buddha would say, "How you doing? Seven of spades." And people would freak out because they didn't know about speakers at the time. So it's pretty amazing how slowly we have to keep evolving the art form. You know, because you have to keep outrunning the disbursement of ideas and technology. People get more educated, more smart, and a magician has to keep going further and further. And that's what we do.
Is that challenging, though? Like, is it threatening? I mean, that some random kid on Reddit is going to go and say, "Hey, look, he did the thing, and that's how he did the thing."
It makes you work harder, doesn't it? It really does. I mean, back in the day where you know, when James Cameron had The Abyss and things were moving, or Terminator movies where they had the amazing CGI, you know, I've got to compete with that, you know. But it was great because it forced me to really think about how to present live something that really wasn't the level of that, or Jurassic Park, or any of those things. How do you take the people on that same journey when they're seeing such incredibly technological things every day? And it's a very good motivation.
That's an interesting way to think about it. I hadn't thought about the idea that you are competing with this little screen that does this magical thing and trying to blow them away. We were fortunate enough to come to your show yesterday and experienced a few things that I'm still having trouble processing.
And coming from you, that's great. You know, people are into technology so much, to have them amazed at a show like mine is very rewarding. And it's very motivating. You know, I keep wanting to come up with new things that kind of take it another direction. There's so much exposure on the internet, you know, it's kind of good in a way because it forces me to keep, me and my team, to keep finding new ways. In that process, we're inventing new things, and that's very good.
Here in the museum, there are things, though, that are largely mechanical, not batteries and Bluetooth, but that were hundreds of years old, that were done with just someone's bare hands and some wood, that are truly amazing illusions.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, it's a way of thinking. You know, you use the tools that you have. At that time, you're right, it was metal and wood and automatons and all of that. When they start to learn about electricity and use electricity, we were in the horse and buggy. A lot of this, these guys were horse and buggy guys. They literally were that. And women, not just guys. But to have a thing to do that, when they start to find electricity, to control the electron, to control, using speakers, technology, all of that, we start to use all of those things that were given to us.
Yeah. There almost seems to be a fascination in this time frame and the time frame that we read about in the book with automata, right? This idea that something has a soul, a tiny little person baking a cake in kind of a tiny house, or a little person that's talking and they're only this tall.
Right. Well, it was the smartphone of the day, wasn't it? It was the internet of the day. or ether, you know, the fact that ether, you could have a chemical and you could pass out with a chemical. It's like, wow, really? And magicians would use that as an excuse to make magic happen, things that ether couldn't do, to levitate somebody. So they would take what was in the public ether, you know, and use that actual thing in, not unlike what I did in the show last night. You know, I did a thing with a cell phone. The audience was sent an email and they went home with an email that hopefully amazed them to a certain extent. So I took what is active today in people's minds and combined that with what I'm doing in my show. And I think that's, we continue to do that.
And that brings up an interesting question around the role of the audience. In your shows, the audience is never passively letting the magic wash over them. You bring them up on stage, you involve them and their phones.
Yes. And I think, you know, I make a real big effort to take the magic off the stage. I do it in the middle of the audience. I have things hang over, you know, 7 feet over the stage to kind of break that fourth wall. It's the experience you get in a movie. If you really watch a film, you immerse yourself in that world. You kind of forget about the frame, you go into it. And for me, the stage shouldn't be just a proscenium. The stage should be a place that can be the start of the energy happening in the audience. So if you notice in the show, I do things in the middle of the audience. Things happen over their heads. You know, dinosaurs come right, you know, 2 feet away from them. And it's a concerted effort to make kind of a 3D movie out of a live show, which is a lot of fun. So again, it's using every piece of technology that exists to kind of, how do we push it forward? How do we make it new and fresh and exciting?
Mm-hmm. You mentioned in the book that Howard Thurston said, one of the first magicians to say, I love my audience. Were there magicians that did not love their audiences and maybe thought of them as being people to be fooled? And then at some point in the zeitgeist, they shifted with a love toward the audience. And then that did that change magic itself?
That's interesting. I think that there is certain performers that want to challenge, you know, a lot of these performers have their eyebrows raised, you know, that the look of I'm better than you. You know, that certainly has never worked for me. You know, I've always been kind of, I dress like the people in the audience. I didn't dress in costume. I really, really tried to be the everyman. And I thought that would make the magic more magical because they had a baseline of reality, even in me. I think that there is something to be said for the performer that really, you know, speaks to the person's dreams and hopes. Every musical artist that succeeds has a relatability to them. You know, Frank Sinatra, you know, you knew his women problems, you knew his, all that stuff. You know, Taylor Swift today, you know about her makeups and breakups, you know, and I think that's the relatable thing. That didn't exist in magic. I put that into magic because I was jealous of all the playwrights and the singers and the songwriters that told personal things. And I think there's a connection based on that. All my magic is very personal. It's about my family. It's about my dreams as a kid. It's about all that stuff. And I think that that communicates an idea. And, you know, you're a technologist person. And I think all the people that have succeeded with technology have found the way to make it accessible, make it, you know, livable, you know, and make it something you can really relate to. And people who've succeeded have taken technology and made it something that people could really use, and they could see themselves use that all that amazing things in their personal and daily life.
Yeah. You're speaking to a sense of empathy for the other people, like truly caring about them, and then taking that technology through storytelling and then relating it empathetically to their
That's life. What I just tried to say. You did it very well.
Well, that's very kind, sir. You know, one of the things that made me realize also is that right now we are obsessed with superheroes. Everything's about superheroes. But in reading the book, whether it be the scary superhero villains of the witches of the 1500s to the superhero magicians of the early 1900s, there's a superhero origin story for a lot of these. These were the superheroes of the early 1900s.
I think so. They cause people to dream, to fantasize about another world. Not unlike, you know, the whole Marvel universe. You know, it's all of these people in the room, I think every single one didn't come from a silver spoon background. They really came from, you know, the struggle to survive. You know, all of us try to survive. As a kid, I wasn't good at baseball, sports wasn't very good. I tried ventriloquism to survive, you know. I kind of was not that good at that, but it led me to magic. I said, oh, maybe I'm good at this, you know. And we all have to find what we're good at, I think. I guess our people watching this are all people who are good at technology and organization and numbers and that. And I love it. Am I great at it? When I have to be, you know, but I kind of select the moments of time where I will learn everything I can about technology, this kind of technology or that kind of technology, when I need to create a piece of magic. You know, it's always purposeful. But back to your question, I think all these people were survivors. They had to survive, and they found magic as their tool to do that, and hopefully to inspire people to think about a future reality.
Yeah. And within their stories is not just the invention of new magic tricks, but also the reinvention of one's self. Have you found the need to like reinvent? You ever just come in somewhere and go, you know, this is not working. We're going to reinvent. And how many times have you reinvented?
All the time, every day. But it's not just because of changing your outfit, your haircut, or like, you know, like show business to keep having a new logo or whatever. It's really about moving forward in every way. You know, there's many people that do the same thing and that's it, where they're done. But people that are moving an art form forward or a technology forward or a business forward are always looking for the new thing. What can we do to move this forward? The byproduct of that is reinventing yourself. That's the byproduct. But the whole point of my thing is finding something that's worth doing, finding something that's going to fascinate me and to how can I contribute? How can I do something that's unique in a different way? I have a lot of associations with scientists and physicists and futurists. And I'm fortunate enough to hear about all the new stuff that comes out in a very early stage. And I can use those things in my show, you know, before it gets out. Or I can disguise it in a way that it doesn't look apparent that it's the thing you saw at CES last week, you know. So I enjoy that. I enjoy that process of the collaboration with people who are really great in different areas of technology.
It seems like you were very blessed to have found your thing early on. You found a thing that you were so geeked about that you're just like, have you heard the news about this thing? And sometimes right now I see in modern times, and certainly during COVID, it's been very challenging. Some of our early in career people, whether it be at Microsoft or in other places, they just don't seem to have found a thing. How do we help them find something that they're so excited about that they're going to do it for 40 or 50 years?
You know, with my kids, I'm trying to figure that out. You know, what's the thing? You know, how do I get the fire? Where does a fire come from? You know, part of it for me, you know, in my generation, it's fear-based, you know. I'm not sure that's that healthy, but it's true. I mean, I was afraid of, you know, of not being able to eat. I was afraid of not, you know, making a mark, afraid of not being, you know, having a purpose. And I think that's still inside of me. I still enjoy that process, you know. The people, and you know, there's lots of people who've had success, and then it just stops. And it's I watch them. And it's because they lost the fire of it, you know. And there's been times in my life where I lost that motivation. People were taking my technology and my work and doing it. And I looked like a copy of myself, you know what I'm saying? A copy of what they were doing. And I kind of was unmotivated to find new ways of doing this. So I put my energy to something else. Luckily, I could, you know, put my energy towards making a magical resort in the Bahamas. So I was able to do that and find the motivation to do stuff on stage again in a unique way. So we all have blue periods in our life, periods that we kind of have these roadblocks and they defeat us. But my technique was to find another path to focus on. And that really helped me to discover a motivating a possibility for my future. And I keep doing that. That's good.
That's great. It's interesting that you said that part of it was fear-based because for me, food security was a thing.
The and ability to eat.
The ability to simply, I'm eating today.
Right.
Like dinner will happen today.
Yeah.
Was not guaranteed.
Right.
And I'm very blessed to not have that problem right now.
Yeah, that's good.
But I don't think that I've fully internalized it.
And it's still there. It's still part of you, right?
It is still there, isn't it?
Yeah. For me, wasn't food. It was paying a heating bill. You know, I'd be there with my girlfriend at the time and I'm counting, okay, I got this much money in the bank, you know, and if I pay, you know, the rent is this much and this, how many months of life do I have, you know, to do that? And my parents would help with the heating bill, you know, every now and then. And, but that's still there, you know, that fear is still there. And I think, you know, to find that in a healthy way is not a bad thing, to have that kind of, that drive to make sure that you're not, you know, you are moving forward, you know.
Yeah, I think that you're making a really important point that it is okay to find that in a healthy way. You know, that doesn't necessarily need to turn into a crushing blue period. And the way that you phrase that, we all have blue periods. Certainly there are concerns about depression and everyone's really challenged right now in the world. But if you can find it in yourself to use those moments to push forward.
I mean, for me, it's like finding another road, finding a road. Okay, I'm good at solving problems. I'm good at creating things. I'm good at, you know, communicating things. If, you know, you get shut down, nobody cares about you. Is there another road to use those abilities? You know, we all have something. We all have something. How do we use it? How do we find that path to kind of, and by finding that path, it might be a side path, it'll answer another door. Other doors will open, I think.
Speaking of opening doors, coming into this museum, we'll have some shots of that a little later. I think we've got some footage. But maybe you could explain where we are right now and why the door to here isn't the door that people would expect.
Well, this is kind of the Smithsonian of magic, I think. This is the, you know, spent many, many years in having many collections all combined in one place to kind of anchor this art form. In many ways, performers, inventors, writers, artists, poster makers, all that stuff, all is influenced by magic. Here it is. Unfortunately, there's so many secrets in there, so I can't make it open to the public. The reason we wrote the book was to have a way of kind of giving a tour. Did somebody get the actual book from it's in the office there. So we can hold up a real
one. Oh, this is great. Pardon me. So just for context, for our friends at Microsoft, I was holding an early copy. But, oh, look at that. That's beautiful. It's got the gold.
Not too shabby. That looks like a Christmas gift.
That does look like a lovely Christmas gift or a coffee table book for you and your families. And I have read this book and dog-eared it, and now I'm going to have another one to dog-ear.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so sorry. So you were saying, though, that I was actually when I was reading this and then came here, I was like, oh, that photograph, and that was taken here, and that's that.
It's a way of giving a tour of some of the highlights of this place that people don't get to see. We do exhibitions outside of the museum here. We take this and bring it to New York, part of it, and do exhibitions and these cases and so forth. And people love it, really love it. We did it at the New York Historical Society in New York, amazing museum. We've done it in places in L.A., all around the world. But we have to preserve the secrets, and that's why this can't be open to the public.
Your app has users. You owe it to them to take their security seriously. Do you want your authentication system to be something your developers built as a side project? Or do you want an enterprise-grade solution that has compliance, security, and industry standards built in as first principles? I'm describing Auth0, an identity platform built for developers. With Auth0, you can save hundreds or thousands of hours in implementation and maintenance. With this premier solution for identity, you can configure advanced features like social login, single sign-on, and multi-factor authentication. Focus on what you're good at and let Auth0 manage what they're best at, helping you deliver the best, safest user experience possible. Make login their problem, not yours. Visit auth0.com to learn more.
The preservation of secrets, it seems like, would be really challenging in the world of social media where everyone's got a phone and everyone's trying to think that they're the clever one who can crack the secret. But as a general rule, at least from the outside, it doesn't feel like that's happened. Are you all the magi one step ahead of us, that you're not letting those secrets out?
Well, you know, if you want to learn about magic secrets, you can. You can search and take the time and find it on the internet. My secrets, I do something kind of interesting. People started trying to reveal how I did things. So what I did was I created a bunch of sites with false methods. and a lot of people come up to me in the street and go, you know, I saw you did that because I saw on the internet. And I said, well, that was me that did that. We just did that, you know. And we have a lot of fun with that, having, you know, the things that have the most hits are my kind of false paths that I do. But I think people have a need to dream. They don't really want to know. People have learned so much about magic through the internet and through books and so forth, and they've kind of forget it. You know, how things, they forget it. And they still come to my show and they go like this, even though it was revealed. It's really interesting how, you know, psychologically, the need to dream, the need to travel to another place is has more strength than puzzle finding. You know, I have two kinds of audience members. One audience member sits there and kind of literally comes to the show multiple times, which we don't mind, to try to deduct in how I did things. And they'll sit there with their arms crossed and doing like that. So I'll watch them. And then that's one half of the audience. And the other half of the audience really wants to just let it wash over them and really enjoy the dream and the thing. And really are motivated by that. You know, I'm prototyping a lot of humankind's future achievements in my show. And it's all real, except for one thing. One part of it that we haven't solved yet in technology or science, I do with magic technology. So eventually, hopefully, we'll solve that. We'll be able to really teleport. You know, we'll be able to really, you know, do all kinds of things that we're working on now for real.
It's funny that you say that there are two kinds of people, because I experienced both kinds just by myself. I showed up and I was like, okay, you know, I'm a techie. And I steepled my fingers and I sat there. And then a spaceship appeared over my head and flew away. And I was just like, and I just let it wash over me. And I was like, you know, I have no idea how that was done. And don't tell me, no spoilers. I just love it.
Thank you.
And it was overwhelming. That particular illusion, I'm going to be walking around and just, you're just walking around and you just go, and it hits you again.
Oh, that's nice. Well, you made my month. That's good. We worked hard on that. You know, we worked, so many years went into that one little moment. And like a ballet dancer, you know, it looks effortless at the end of the day. Like Fred Astaire dancing around, you don't see the bloody toes and the, you know, the Russian ballet mistress yelling at you. You see just the end result. And magic is very much that, you know. It's very much analogous to that. Or technology, where people are killing themselves, solving, trying to solve it, and finally one day, oh, it's easy. And then we suddenly take it for granted. So we worked really hard on that. Oh, I know, but now it's the simple thing. And magic is that, you know. And that's an example of something we have so many. To get to that point was really hard,
yeah.
You know. You'll see in the theater, if you notice, there was a bunch of TVs over your head. That was once part of that illusion. And we use it as a piece of scenery now, but it was part of the illusion that we, you know, got rid of. You know, when the Pixar movies are out, you know, they take 7 years, to make that movie. Rewriting, firing directors, and we take a lot of strength in that, because that's the process for our show, is to go through all those different things and failure, and then finally it works. And it's just a beautiful, simple result.
Yeah. You know, in the technology world right now, we do similar things. We'll work for years, we'll come out with a thing, and then someone on the internet will say the word just. Oh, you just did this. And in doing that, they take away the amount of work. In the book, you mention, and you've mentioned in interviews, that there's this illusion of spontaneity, where something you work on for years happens for 30 seconds. But then it stays with you for the rest of your life, if you did it right.
That's right. And you, hopefully they don't say just. You
never.
Know, oh, they say, well, they do sometimes, but you know, hopefully they don't. It touches somebody, mm-hmm. you know, internally. It makes, oh, and they say, well, I really experienced that moment, you know. For me, it's all about experiences, making experiences. And if the experience is really right, then you can maybe motivate a couple people to maybe make it real, you know. They have that visualizing makes things real. Georges Méliès, who took over the Theatre Robert-Houdin, was one of the fathers of cinema. Movies was a magic effect. It was not storytelling. It was a magic effect. They discovered you can make things move, not just with a flip book, but projected trains coming at you. And people go, whoa! And that was a trick, just a magic illusion in the show. But Georges Méliès said, we're going to tell stories with this. And had special effects. He gets credit for special effects and stop motion and you know, stopping the frame and have things appear and so forth. And it was really beautiful. And Trip to the Moon, all that stuff.
Trip to the Moon.
But he actually really introduced storytelling using the magic effect of cinema as a storytelling thing. And I've had filmmakers come here and they see my Méliès stuff and they start to get very emotional. They start to cry. And I said, why are you crying? I know why they're crying. You know, they say, well, this is the beginning. This is this is how we started. This is my whole life is that. It started by this magician saying, we're going to tell stories with this stuff. And then, of course, with special effects that he took, because he was a magician, he layered special effects into all of this. So I think the trip to the moon example is great because he had a trip to the moon, Jules Verne, you know, story, landing on the moon. And we visualized, for the first time, we got to see it. You know, we got to see it. As kooky as it was, and as fun as it was, and, you know, I don't think there's a man in the moon, necessarily, with the, you know, drippy stuff, you know. It wasn't like that. But seeing it, I think, really changes real scientists. And less than 70 years later, we landed on the moon. 70 years later. From seeing it to actually happening, that's pretty good.
Yeah, and Robert Houdin is, I'm thinking, I wrote down that he was possibly the father of the modern smart home as well.
Correct. You know, a lot of things that are magic effects have become reality. In upstairs, we have a door that opens up with electricity. And it could count the number of people coming to that. He'd know who's in the house, how many people are in the house, and the door would open. Now every grocery store opens up with that thing. You know, his horses were fed with an automatic feeder. These were magic tricks. Now they're reality.
I know my kids are mad if they can't get the smart assistant to turn the lights on in 5 seconds.
Imagine. But I know you exist. Therefore, I do what I do. I think it's great to know the people who are smart as you or as into that view of the world. The fact that you exist makes me work harder and differently, you know? Yes. Speaking of the moon, do you know about my secrets on the moon?
Your specific secrets?
Yes.
No.
There's a thing that called nanofish, you know, microfish. Mm-hmm. Where you can etch words and pictures and so forth into nickel, which is going to last billions of years. Nickel doesn't degrade. And the Arch Mission Foundation put all my secrets on these discs. And we blasted it off. And it was supposed to land gently on the moon. On a moon lander. Unfortunately, it didn't land so softly. But it did land. And it exists because that is an object of indestructibleness. Finding it's a little bit hard. My secrets literally are on the moon. You need a microscope to read all of the information. But in a non-degradable nickel form, it's up there. And it's an amazing feeling to walk out and seeing the moon up there and saying that something that I touched, that I thought about, inventions and collaborations are literally lying on the surface of the moon.
And what would Millier think about that?
Wow, that would be good. I would love to ask him that question, you know. He'd say, I know, we could stop the camera and make it happen immediately. I don't know what he'd say, but it's pretty cool.
Yeah. In building this museum, early on, you would go looking for things. People then would come looking for you. And one of the things that was really interesting was that you showed us a trick that you had learned at Macy's. Maybe you could tell us about the gentleman at Macy's that showed you that trick.
Sure. I went to Macy's looking for a ventriloquist dummy because I thought that was my path. I wasn't very good. Maybe the dummy was going to have had a better dummy. Macy's sold some ventriloquist dummies, but it was at the Macy's magic counter. And there was a guy named Danny Tsakoulis, who did this amazing piece of magic with a board and a coin. And the coin would disappear, and it was wonderful. And it was the first trick that I ever learned. I hate to call these things tricks, but it was kind of this first effect that I learned. And he did it like Pavarotti singing, like Baryshnikov dancing. It was a piece of art. I kind of stumbled through it, but it was the first piece of magic that guided me on my path to all this. And when I created this museum with my amazing team, the beginning of the museum starts with that counter in Macy's to say that was my journey. You know, it's through a counter in a big department store. That piece of magic started all this and let me learn about these incredible people.
And did he find you after the fact, and his family found you somehow?
Yes, I was on television, and I was, you know, was signing autographs after the show, and there he was with his daughter in his 90s, and I got to see him after all this. He came backstage and did his coin trick for my crew, and they were mouth agape. They didn't steeple their fingers. They were like, oh my God. And it showed you the power of magic. A 90-year-old guy was able to do this because it was in his, he did it a million times to feed his family this little board trick and sold them every day at Macy's. But to watch him do it in the twilight of his life for all of my crew who, you know, my crew doesn't want to see any magic stuff. They want to eat pizza and, you know, play some, but they were like enthralled by this piece and it showed the power of this one little thing.
How do you balance the evolution of magic, pushing the boundaries of things versus the classics? Because the way you described that, it was the perfect effect. And it could not be improved upon.
Well, you know, you can improve upon that. You know, you talk about the board thing.
Mm-hmm.
You can improve it. You know, you get rid of the board. You do it by pure sleight of hand. Harder to sell, you know. He could, you know, from the merchandising center, he could sell that prop.
Right.
You can improve upon it. But the way he did that piece with the board was so beautiful, and so, you know, after all those years of doing it, he found the perfect, you know, magic of it, you know? It was really, really amazing. And it shows you that if you could do one thing in life really that good, you know, there's something very special about it. He was able to do that one thing that's as a miracle.
It sounds like you got a lot of energy from that experience.
Well, yeah, I mean, it really motivated this. Years later, after he passed away, his family sent a crate to this warehouse. We've got a present for you because, you know, we know you loved our father. Opened the crate, and it was the counter from Macy's where I started. So that's the beginning of this whole thing, is that counter where I began discovering magic is here in the museum.
Do those moments re-energize you? Because sometimes we talked about the moments of blue. I'll think to myself, yeah, I'm kind of bored. Maybe I'll retire, and then I'll see something or do something, or I'll just be walking down the street and I'll have an idea. And then I'll be like, I'm not going to retire yet. I've got a lot more stuff to do, and I don't get bored.
Well, that's good. I think, you know, I keep finding new ways. I have periods that I'm very discouraged. I focus my microscope on things aren't going very well, or I'm not able to solve certain problems, or, you know, I don't like interaction that's happening to me a certain way. And I do get, you know, struck down,
mm-hmm.
but then I do kind of pick myself up and find a new way to be energized again. You know, it is out there, and I get a lot of strength from people who've survived being knocked down over and over.
Yeah, that is definitely a superhero story.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure I'm a superhero, but, you know, I pretend to be. I play one on TV.
Well, I think the superhero story for me is not necessarily that they can do anything and they can walk through walls or whatever, but it's the that Captain America moment of, like, I can do this all day. And you keep getting knocked down and you keep sitting up regardless.
Yeah. Well, that's definitely my path, you know, a lot of knockdowns. And, you know, everybody that, you know, in technology also, the stories in technology of people that have failed and failed and failed, and then boom, they suddenly this thing that a gift the world is given. And it's always, it's not an easy ride for anybody, right? And the stories are incredible in your world, you know, and it's all superhero stories, right? You know, you just got to get up, got to show up.
Yeah. In the book, there's a period from about 1925, where there's this huge burst of technology. It's mostly electricity-based. There's electromagnets and all kinds of things like that. I'm curious if there's a particular tech in the last, you know, 25 to 40 years that stands out to you as being like, yeah, that's the one that really made my job easier, made my job more fun.
Well, I think it's, you know, the communication that's happening now, the internet, Zoom, and all these things are opening up avenues for somebody like me. Opening up the possibility of me seeing quickly things that are being invented now.
Mm.
I'm able to see and being shared with new things that I can't talk about now because I want to put it in my show.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, incredible things that are existing out there. They're just world-changing things, applying them, having them useful and practical, making them practical is the real challenge. And it's when it happens, it's a lot of hard work, but when it finally happens, it's glorious. I get to use it for a while, and then you get to use it, and the public gets to use it. let me have it for a while. Yeah. But then eventually it'll become something. And I can maybe still use it if I disguise it in a certain way. Don't make it look like things that you're familiar with. Mm-hmm. A lot of that happened last night in the show.
It did. The book, you know, effectively covers like 500 years of magic. And I wonder if there's another 500 years in you somewhere. Was there a lot of magic before, you know, the 1500s? What were we doing in other continents even earlier?
Well, magic has existed in all kinds of cultures before the book. In China, you know, street performers in India, South America. You know, when I went to China to walk through the Great Wall, I saw Chinese magicians who were doing things that really amazed me. Technology that I didn't see. Fish, they produce fish, living fish like this. You know, and, you know, of course you'd figure out how to, with my background, you didn't know, but the way they did it was so unique, and things that don't exist in these books, that really shows that really existed culturally in a very strong way before even, you know, 1584, the discovery of witchcraft, mm-hmm. which is that book right there, the first book teaching magic, mm-hmm. is that book. We have other volumes here that are how tombs will open. These are magic tricks. Light an urn and a tomb opens. Using hydraulics and pneumatic, you know, all those kind of pipes and energy to make religious experiences take place. They weren't in magic books, but they're in various volumes like that, which we have here that predate that.
I see.
So, but that's the first book that really talks about a magic being, how to perform it, how to demonstrate it like that.
As an art, like they weren't identified. Well, it's like you could look and say that was magic in 1000 BC, but no one had that word?
It wasn't prestidigitation. It wasn't sleight of hand. It wasn't that. And that book really started to, written to stop people from burning magicians as witches, you know what I'm saying? To really protect that. And the king didn't like that. And, you know, it goes into that in our book. But I think magic existed really, really early. It keeps refining and defining itself. You know, my whole goal is to take what I'm doing and inspire people to create reality for humanity. Then it's a good thing. Entertainment is important, but if I can make a kid, not in like Melies, a trip to the moon, we landed on the moon 70 years later. I can do something of that nature and really make something that magic is the secret. Hopefully the magic part can become reality. So the gift to mankind is an inspirational moment that can make our lives better.
So no fear that magic is going to wither as technology continues?
No fear, no. It's challenging sometimes. It's harder, you know, today because people are so smart and they know these things exist. And my job is to either misdirect them from what they know or invent new technology to keep it the magic magical. You know, and I can't repeat myself. I can't repeat the same things over and over again. I have to really keep it moving forward in a way. And for years before the internet, it was a little bit easier because you could maintain similar things and redress them. I can't do that today.
Always new ideas, something going on that we don't know about now, but 10 years ago, I'm going to say I saw that in a Copperfield show.
If I do it right, you know, I'm still trying to get it right. And that's what keeps me going.
Fantastic. And folks can learn a lot more about the history of magic with this wonderful book.
Thank you.
David Copperfield's History of Magic. I've enjoyed it very much. Thank you for the hardback copy. I feel bad about my dog-eared and highlighted paperback copy. And now have been replaced with this one instead. So thank you so much for chatting with us today and for inviting us into your wonderful museum.
Thank you. I loved your questions. And thank you out there. Really appreciate it.
All right. We've been talking with David Copperfield. This has been Outside In. We'll see you again next time.